welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I am your host. On today's episode, we'll talk about an issue that is both taboo and novel, perhaps in equal measure, surrogacy. Just the mention of the word elicits hope for would-be parents who are unable to conceive and fear in the more conservative among us. But today we're going to attempt to demystify it. Our guest is Dr. Muthomi Thiankolu, a partner at Muthomi and Karanja Advocates and a lecturer at the University of Nairobi School of Law. Welcome, Dr. Thiankolu.
Thank you very much, Jean. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. Let's start with the basics. What is surrogacy?
Very simply stated, surrogacy is an arrangement in which a woman or a couple that for one reason or another is unable to have a child because the woman can carry a pregnancy or she can carry to term, engage another woman to carry a baby on their behalf. And whereas we are only discussing the matter as novel in the sense of modern human reproduction technology. Surrogacy is actually a very old arrangement. If you read your Bible in the Old Testament, Sarah having waited for about 99 or whatever years without a baby, if you recall, asked Abraham whether he would sleep with the maid and bear a child for her. And I believe that child was called Ishmael.
Yes.
That was a surrogacy arrangement. The understanding was and still remains in today's basic understanding of surrogacy. The woman carrying the pregnancy, carrying the baby, is just lending her womb for purposes of incubating the baby and would surrender the baby upon birth and would lay no claim to the parenthood of the baby. In very short and very easy, straightforward conception, that's what surrogacy is.
And I feel like this is a misconception that I have been walking around with. A surrogate doesn't necessarily have to just be the mother who can't conceive. Let me use this example that you've just used. The maid, I think her name was Haggai.
Yes.
Was a womb for hire, even though the egg was hers, for Sarah.
Yes.
So the parents who would be classified as the parents of Ishmael was Sarah and Abraham, even though the blood mother was still Haggai.
Correct. I think what you're raising is the concept of the distinction between genetic parenthood and legal parenthood.
Yes.
And even outside of surrogacy, generally speaking, in our family law, parenthood has different facets. And the fact that you are the genetic parent of any one child does not necessarily mean you're also the legal parent. Parentage can be transferred through, parent orders in countries like the UK, in Kenya, it can be transferred through an order for adoption. And in the more of the practical lived sense, other than the legal sense, parentage can also be transferred through fostering. Many of us in this country actually were brought up by an auntie, an uncle, some grandparents, or some relative, so to speak, who are not necessarily our genetic or biological parents, but they were our parents for all practical and sometimes for all legal purposes.
That is true.
Yes.
Can we go through the legal framework that regulates surrogacy in Kenya? Do we have a legal framework that regulates surrogacy in Kenya?
We don't, and it is unfortunate that this is the case, because as you would be aware, our legal system actually, even as a system of marriage, they call woman-to-woman marriage, which is really nothing other than a surrogacy by another name. So I'm surprised that in a country like Kenya, where I think we had our first IVF babies more than a decade ago, with all the advances in modern science and technology, where now there are very many medical means of surmounting childlessness, but the government has not seen it fit to enact a law. And I recall when I was a young man, about 15 years ago, actually writing a journal article lamenting about this problem, that Kenya has no legal framework for regulating surrogacy. The courts have equally lamented, because there have been several legal cases in our courts where people enter into an arrangement that is in the nature of surrogacy, and later on issues arise as to either the surrender of the baby to the surrogate parents, or the issuance of registration documents such as birth certificates and national identity cards, sometimes questions of travel and immigration. All these are problems that have been thrown to Kenyan courts, and I recall the earliest time this matter came to a court was in 2014. And actually in 2014, we had two cases about surrogacy. One was before Justice Lenaola. Those days he was in the High Court. Another one was before Justice Majanja. And in one of them, the issue was that a British couple had commissioned a Kenyan woman to be a surrogate mother. And questions arose as to whether Kenyatta National Hospital would register the British foster mother as the legal parent so that the British couple could take away the child to England, or whether the birth mother, in this case, who is the surrogate mother, was to be registered as the mother of the child. And the problem was that in our law, there is a statute called Registration of Births and Deaths. And that statute says, defines birth as the procession from the woman's birth canal of a baby, and therefore, for purposes of the Kenyan legal system in its current status, the legal mother of a baby
is the one that surrogate mother.
Was the surrogate mother. Never mind that the surrogate mother, and in that particular case, absolutely no connection, not even genetically, because the baby had been conceived through IVF using the eggs from the commissioning mother and the sperm from the commissioning mother's husband. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the surrogate mother, who our law was insisting is the mother of the child, as I said earlier in the introduction, had done no more other than to lend an incubator, otherwise known as a womb. Yeah.
I do believe in that case they asked for an opinion from the Attorney General's office, and originally the notification of birth that would lead to the birth certificate was written in the names of the commissioning parents.
Yes.
Then they chose to leave the country.
Yes.
And they needed now documentation to leave, and that's where they hit a complete wall and they had to come back.
Yes.
Where if we were to do a comparison between UK law and Kenya law, I think UK law has an option of a parental agreement or an arrangement that transfers responsibility from one parent to another. But in Kenya law, I think the only option that was made available to them was adoption.
Let me give you, yes, you're absolutely right. And let me tell you a case I handled when I was a pupil.
Yes.
In the year 2007, which was one of the most interesting type of things you could do in an environment that has no law in Kenya. A man from Spain walked to our office then in Nairobi, and he was working with an international organization, and he wanted to be a sperm donor. And then he had identified a couple that had fertility issues. And in this case, it is the, between that couple, it is the husband who had fertility problems. So they were willing to get sperm from this client of ours and have his wife artificially inseminated. Now, the husband was a British national.
The donor?
Living in London.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife was a Kenyan national living in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So this guy walks to our office, asks us to draft a sperm donation agreement. We didn't know what to do. I recall us going to the fertility center at Nairobi Hospital back then. And one of the immediate problems we ran into was the lack of a law, and the hospital telling us, this thing you want to do, we can't facilitate because the donor has already been disclosed. We only facilitate it for anonymous donors. So we asked him, why do you insist on anonymous donors? And they said, we don't want to be faced with legal claims in an environment that is not regulated. I mean, there are all manner of potential problems that could arise. The child could lay claim to the sperm donor, who in this case would be their genetic father. They could lay claim to his estate as a question of inheritance. They could lay claim for child care and maintenance from him as the biological father. And yet our client didn't want to be saddled with anything in the nature of parental responsibility. He didn't want his estate, if he died, to be saddled with any claims from the child resulting. And in that case, you can see the messy web that we are getting into for purposes of private international law. Our challenge was granted the fact that there was no law did not necessarily mean what we were asked to draft would not be legal in Kenya. I mean, the mere absence of a law does not necessarily mean it's illegal.
That is true.
But then we had to have in mind, what are its implications for marital law in this country now that the woman was a Kenyan citizen? Would the agreement we drafted be recognized in the Democratic Republic of Congo or in Spain, where the donor came from, or in the United Kingdom, where the woman's husband was domiciled? And would they be recognized in Kenya, notwithstanding? In fact, it is that assignment that inspired me to write.
To write this paper that you
the
wrote.
The article that I wrote way back in 2007.
And the article, which you can find if you just Google it, is called Towards a Legal Framework on Assisted Human Reproduction Technologies in Kenya. I think you raised those challenges, yes. And I find them very interesting.
Yeah.
The challenges on, first of all, before we get to succession and estates, just the first question on anonymity versus a well-known donor. What does that mean for the donor? Does the donor then acquire parental rights and responsibilities? Can the donor activate those rights and responsibilities? What does that mean for registration of the child? Whose names go on that birth certificate? Do the names of the commissioning parents go on the birth certificate, or do the names of the surrogate parents go on the birth certificate? Then finally, we get into the child. I think this whole situation is hypothetical. Mm. But now that it's already happening in Kenya, if I am or if I were a child conceived through surrogacy, do I have the right in this era of access to information, when ideally I should be able to access any information about myself, to get information on my surrogate parents?
It's a good question. And as a matter of fact, there has been a decision less than 2-3 weeks ago in which Kenyan courts, if I saw the caption correctly, had ruled that such a child has a right to know their genetic parents. But then there are many other legal issues that arise from the whole question of anonymous versus disclosed or identified
donors
of whether it's egg or sperm.
Yes.
One of the reasons you may want to know who they are is just in case you have a genetic condition that may require early management. Say you have a gene for, say, cancer. You might want to know that information so that then you can take preemptive steps. So there may be valid medical reasons why you may want to know that information, why a child might want to know that information. As a matter of personal identity, the rights of the child, see, a child has a right to a family, they have a right to know their parents, they have a right to be taken care of by their parents. The only question is whether it's the surrogate parents or the genetic parents. And then, of course, what happens sometimes is in the realm of all human relations, people enter into an agreement with certain clear, very noble intentions. Then along the way, they develop other ideas. Let's suppose you are commissioned as a surrogate mother. You have carried a baby in your womb for 9 months, you've delivered the baby, and then you get sentimentally attached to the baby and suddenly said, no, I am not going actually to surrender this baby to you. The agreement we made, you can shred it or you can take me wherever you want.
But I'm keeping this baby.
But
this is my child.
This is my child. I bought it. I delivered it in the maternity ward. So to hell with you. The other moral and ethical issues that arise from the technologies that we have today for surrogacy and other forms of assisted human reproduction, one of them is a problem people call designer babies. Can you go and decide, because Mr. X is such a brilliant man, therefore, I'll go borrow either sperm from him, or Miss Y is such a brilliant lady or such a beautiful lady, I'll go borrow the egg from them and then, you know, incubate through IVF, you know, some sort of designer baby. And the ethical issues that arise as to whether human reproduction should be spontaneous, just be left to natural spontaneity,
let nature
or whether
take its course.
It should be tweaked. assisted in a laboratory through test tubes and burettes and whatever, and pipettes and whatnot. There are questions that arise about cloning. How cloning is done is you take a human egg from a woman, take another, you know, the nucleus from a body cell, and you can reproduce a person who is an exact carbon copy of the person you're seeking to clone. Or now that human cloning is subject of a universal ban, mostly the scientists clone animals, usually sheep. I don't know why the obsession with the sheep.
I think it's because Dolly was successful. Yes. So after Dolly.
So the question would be then, what kind of chaos that would introduce? Because it would mean if somebody committed a crime and you were to do, say, DNA analysis of the scene, assuming we used the cells or whatever to do through surrogacy or any other form of assisted human reproduction, 100 copies of Bill Gates or 100 copies of, I don't know, Jomo Kenyatta, whoever you like, then how do you deal with those forensic challenges about identity, about law enforcement? How do you deal even with the ethics of having a person that is a complete carbon copy of another? So for me, these are issues that need to be thought through in a proper legal framework. In the judgments I alluded to, the courts have always directed that the government should formulate policy and enact a law on this very fast evolving area of assisted human reproduction. But the government has not seen it as one of the priority areas for law reform and law enactment. And we continue to lag behind other countries. And the real challenge is we now live in a world that is globalized, at least going by the two cases I told you. You can imagine the sort of immigration and diplomatic problems this could trigger. I hope it's still not too late. Our government can do something about it.
I do agree. However, I do want to take you back to, I think, a new issue that has come to my mind as you were speaking, especially about sperm donors and egg donors. I think I watched a Netflix documentary a couple of weeks ago. I think it's called Our Father. And especially because as I think about the context that we have right now with surrogacy, it's happening in more or less unregulated context. That doesn't mean it's not happening. That just means there is no framework that is regulating it or keeping, there is no database of egg and sperm donors. There is no, essentially, the databases that exist are with anonymity at least within them to protect the institutions that are undertaking it. Now, I think it's America. They have begun this very robust, I think they're called DNA or genetic sites, where you now submit, even just for fun. So I might decide that I would like to know what heritage I have, if I'm a mixture of Kisi and Kikuyu, and maybe there's some Maasai in there and some colonizer Brit blood, and I just submit my DNA for testing. And the unintended consequence of these sites was that they uncovered siblings who did not know they were siblings until they submitted their DNA into these sites, and it linked them to any persons who they had a degree of consanguinity. So it, whether it's first degree, so these are brothers and sisters. And I think in this particular documentary, the doctor was a fertility specialist, and he had an emerging number of children who by the time I finished the documentary were over 50. And what does that bear for us as Kenyans? I think our law allows for siblings who discover that they are siblings, if they have a prohibited degree of consanguinity, to annul a marriage. But what does that mean that we are practicing alternative forms of assisted reproduction and in an unregulated context?
It simply means we could run into very murky ethical waters, because using the example from the documentary you watched, and I think there was also a real case that documentary. What happened, I think, was that a medical practitioner somewhere in the U.S.
Became
the donor, pretending that this was semen he had collected from anonymous donors, and he was just replicating himself, for lack of a better language, by giving his sperm to all these unsuspecting women. The problem is you could, if that happens on a large scale or even on a small scale, there is always a risk you could actually meet and marry someone who is your sister or your brother without knowing. And I think those are some of now the ethical issues that the policy and lawmakers would have to navigate when addressing the question of anonymous vis-a-vis identified egg and sperm donors. And to me, it's a very serious issue. But again, we live in a country where many serious issues are not taken with a seriousness.
They deserve. And one more question. You discussed this in your paper. Mm-hmm. Now, if, for instance, and I think there was a situation like this in that particular documentary that I watched, I am a wife and I'm to be inseminated with my husband's sperm. So it's homologous. Mm-hmm. I think that is the term that you used mm-hmm. in your paper. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. unbeknownst to my husband, mm-hmm. who has given his sperm, there's a switch that happens and another sperm mm-hmm. is put in, as that doctor would do.
Yes.
What happens to the legal rights and responsibilities of my husband mm-hmm. in this context?
It's a very good question, because then the issue is, can he disown parental responsibility
of these children? And would I then claim
from the hospital
or the doctor?
Or from the doctor and whatnot. And again, it just confirms why we need a law on this issue, if you ask me. But then there are also other ethical issues I wanted to tell you. There was a concern, and I think it's still one of the undercurrents in discussions of this matter in the third world, especially. Could surrogacy be exploited by super rich women, usually either from here or from overseas, who don't want to go through, you know, the rigors and troubles of
conception and childbirth. Yes.
They don't want to suffer the morning sickness. They don't want to suffer the stretch marks. They don't want to suffer the labor pains. But they want a child. And because they are moneyed, they come here. And because most of our people are poor, then they commission them. You throw a few cents and shillings to a very desperate woman who is mired in poverty. And then they become your surrogate mother, or like I keep saying, although people may find the language objectionable, your incubator for that purpose. In the UK, for instance, in their law, it's called the Human Fertilization and Embryology Act. Then to navigate this issue, and one of the rules in that act is that surrogacy arrangements, though valid, are not enforceable. And if the surrogate mother is paid money in exchange for an agreement to carry the baby, then that agreement is void and it's contrary to public policy.
I find that very interesting. And you brought us into a topic, surrogacy arrangements.
Yes.
So I'm going to make an assumption. Mm. Based on our case law, mm-hmm. surrogacy arrangements are enforce in Kenya. Mm-hmm. You can walk into any legal lawyer's office and you can have them draft up a surrogacy agreement between two consenting couples, even one, and a surrogate mother. Mm. Once we have this arrangement, is it enforceable in the Kenyan courts? Now that in the UK, it is not enforceable.
We actually don't know, because the two judgments we have,
yes,
there was no dispute between the surrogate mother and the commissioning parents.
Therefore, everything was fine. So the questions were not with regard to the agreement.
The questions were not about the validity or enforceability of the agreement, but the refusal of the registrar of persons or the refusal of the hospital to record certain details in the notification of birth and the birth certificate and whatnot. So we do not have a judicial decision where...
We have an assumption of validity, though.
Where the dispute was between the surrogate mother and the commissioning parents. And therefore, until we have such a dispute, we may not know
whether
such agreements
are actually truly legally enforceable within our jurisdiction.
Yes. Yes.
But in the meantime, surrogacy agreements are being negotiated. What would be the requirements? Like, if I were to negotiate a surrogacy agreement, what are the key things that I should put in place that would attempt to protect me in some way?
One of the things I would put is, one, the agreement would, of course, identify the roles of various parties to the agreement. Who is the surrogate mother in that arrangement? Who is the commissioning mother? If the commissioning mother is married, who is the husband? And whether the husband has consented to that arrangement, you may want that covered just in case there are later issues as to parental responsibility and whatnot. I would want the agreement to specify that the surrogate mother undertakes to surrender the baby either at birth or shortly after birth or at whatever period that is agreed. I would want the agreement to provide who is to bear parental responsibility for that child. And by that, we mean things like food, shelter, clothing, medical care, school fees. I mean, rearing a child is an expensive enterprise that runs for at least 25 to 27 years. And you don't want to be saddled with such burdens unless that was your intention right from the outset. And then, of course, just out of speculation, I would want to be clear whether there is any monetary gain being exchanged for this or in what consideration is being done for this. The reason why that is important, in countries where they refuse to enforce them, I've already told you, in the UK, for instance, the courts and their law is hostile to the idea that a woman could be paid money so that she can carry a child for another. I would also want to clarify, there are two forms of surrogacy. One is called full surrogacy. The other one is called partial surrogacy. It is important to, if possible, to specify in the document. By full surrogacy, we mean an arrangement in which the surrogate mother has no genetic relationship with the baby that she is to carry. And how it is done in terms of the science and the nuts and bolts of it is they harvest the egg from the commissioning mother, then they get the sperm from the commissioning mother's husband or an anonymous donor. Then the egg and sperm are fertilized in a test tube and then put in the surrogate mother's womb through IVF for purposes of gestation. So where it is partial surrogacy, then the egg comes from the surrogate mother. It's exactly what Sarah and Aga did, except that the conception will not be through sexual intercourse, but through artificial
insemination.
Yes.
Thank you. I think that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Muthomi Thiankolu. I think you've taken us through the legal lacuna that is surrogacy in Kenya, just trying to understand what is valid, what is legal. It's the fact that there is no regulation, any specific regulation on surrogacy in Kenya make it illegal, and we've determined, no, it does not. However, there are risks and there are moral and ethical challenges that we, or hurdles that we must try and break apart using law, using policy. And I think it'll be wise to wait for those.
Yeah, also financial hurdles. If you're doing surrogacy through the assisted human reproduction as opposed to through natural sexual intercourse, it's a very expensive affair. IVF is not cheap, whether you're paying in the Kenyan shilling or the US dollar or whichever other currency. But I think that will be a discussion for a different day.
That is true. Thank you again. I'm your host, Jean Kambuni, and we hope that you found this episode informative. Tell us what you like about it on email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Vadgama Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast.